BCFM 93.2, your Bristol station.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Israel's military intelligence chief sits in the Pentagon sipping coffee as Israel bombs Lebanon and Syria with impunity. Yes, this week Israel has bombed what are believed to be Russian arms shipments in Syria and Lebanon as John Kerry takes over from Hillary Clinton, a Secretary of State in the White House, at least that announcement. Anyway, Israeli intelligence chief Aviv Kochavi is in the US at the Pentagon. And a bomb explodes this morning at the entrance of the US Embassy in Ankara, in a country torn between Islam, radical Islam and NATO. Martin Summers takes us on our weekly tour of the world's hotspots. Also, Bristolian Gary McFarlane hits the national news recently. He was sacked for his Christian faith, but does that mean Christians cannot do counselling in Britain? Well, no, he's opened his own practice. So we start this week, Martin, with the pretty shocking news that the Israeli Defence Force, even though they haven't released any media statement about it, it looks pretty clear that they've been bombing targets in Lebanon and in Syria. Now, to what extent is this just a normal thing for the Israelis to be doing, and to what extent is it quite a new move?
Well, they've done it before. It's not the first time they've bombed either Lebanon or Syria. The worrying thing is that it's a sign of escalation of the general Middle East crisis, which is, you know, drifting towards a major full-on regional war.
But the Israelis haven't been bombing Syria during the civil war, have they? It's obvious that they're actually intervening in some way in that war.
Well, I mean, most of the outside powers, including Britain, have been intervening in the war in Syria and in other wars, and the Israelis have been doing the same, no doubt. This is just more overt intervention. You know, airstrikes are, you know, different from putting special forces in.
Now, they're talking about taking out surface-to-air missiles. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance of that is that the Russians are providing the Syrians with Iskander missiles, I understand, which are designed basically to knock out aircraft carriers and incoming
ships.
Aircraft, yeah, but or whatever, you know, they go for fixed point things or ships or anything like that. The point is that the Russians have been providing the Syrian government with sufficient high-tech weaponry to make any kind of outside intervention, direct outside intervention by Israel or anybody else, a bit of an iffy prospect. But the Israelis have just had their election. Netanyahu won. They are pushing for a war with Iran before the summer. And of course, Syria is, you know, stirring the pot in Syria is part of their march to war with Iran, which we're all going to go with them if that's how it plays out.
But certainly reading the reports from the English language press in that part of the world, it seems pretty clear these are surface-to-air missiles. In other words, they're designed to take out aircraft, not ships.
Yes, I mean, if these reports are correct, the Syrians are denying that there was in fact an attack on Russian missiles. They are saying that there was an air attack on a facility near Damascus, which is a sort of research facility. So, you know, people say that truth is the first casualty in war, when in actual fact everybody's saying quite different things about what's supposed to have happened. So it's not in fact clear what has happened.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that these strikes have taken place on the border. Now, what do you think is the significance of that? Is it, I mean, as a convoy is crossing the border, this is a very...
Well, it's the Western powers who are saying that this has taken place. The Israelis have said nothing. The Western powers have said that the Israeli airstrike was on missiles being removed from Syria into Lebanon. The Syrians have a different story to say, saying it was actually an attack upon a sort of research facility near Damascus. The Syrian rebels have further complicated things by saying it was them that attacked the facility near Damascus. And I think basically everybody is fibbing away. That's what's going on. And, you know, you shouldn't presume that you're being told the truth by anybody.
Now, what about the choice of Senator John Kerry? He was, as US Secretary of State to replace Hillary Clinton, he was the Democratic Party's unsuccessful candidate in the 2004 presidential election. He's also a part of this Skull and Bones Society, the same as at Yale University, which is this rather, creepy group that meets in this tomb on the campus. Just as George Bush Senior and George Bush Junior were part of the same group.
Yes, and it looks to me and to many other observers as if Kerry threw in the towel in the during his presidential bid, that in actual fact he won, but he basically, because he was an establishment insider, he surrendered and gave George Bush his second term, which he perhaps shouldn't have done. He's basically an establishment figure. Interestingly enough, Chuck Hagel, who's been put forward as Secretary of Defence, although he's a Republican, has got a history of speaking out against the military-industrial complex and against the Israelis, but he is now backtracking in order to get himself as Secretary of State for Defence. Basically, the elite groups that run US policy are virtually interchangeable. The policy will be determined and they will carry it out.
So it's not quite clear in these news items. I mean, is there a sort of handover period between Clinton and Kerry?
Well, yeah, I presume so. I mean, but the point is that Obama got re-elected and he's now appointing, you know, his second term team, as it were, and they all have to go for Senate confirmation hearings and so on. So there's a whole process of, you know, changing of the guard, as it were.
Well, his appointment has been approved and everything, so I can only presume that he is actually now running the US foreign policy. At the same time, we're seeing this Israeli intelligence chief over at the Pentagon. I mean, is that normal during a raid like this when you know, there's a potential of this being breaking international law, this Israeli raid, and it makes it rather suspicious to have the Israeli intelligence chief sitting in the Pentagon while it's going on.
Well, let's be clear, Britain and the US will not condemn Israel for attacking Syria and Lebanon. The Russians have already made their position clear. It's a breach of international law. So what we're really talking about is, what Netanyahu wants is he wants us all to attack Iran before the summer. And, you know, the British people are not going to be asked, but one way or another, if that goes ahead, we're going to be part of it. And people need to recognise how serious this situation is becoming.
Now, there's another angle to this, and that is the close down of TV channels, because we've already had the close down of Press TV, which is the Iranian-based English language TV station, on what can only be called spurious grounds for some sort of inaccuracy, which is actually very minimal compared to the inaccuracies which come out every day on the official, you know, things like Sky News and the BBC. Unfortunately, you know, this is just part of the way the world is. They're told certain facts, supposedly, by government sources and by military sources, which then later turn out to be nonsense. But the actual channel is a Hispanic channel put out by, it's called Hispan TV, and Spain has now banned it. So a political analyst described the Spanish government's move to take Iran's Hispan TV off the air as illegal and a violation of the principles of democratic system in the country. This actually happened on Thursday, the 24th of January, so it was just before last week's show. It's not quite this week, but the week before. The other interesting angle to this is that the satellite which it's broadcast on, which is called Eutelsat, is actually the chief executive is a what's described as an Israeli Frenchman who's actually in charge of that channel. And then there's the idea is that, you know, who controls these satellites has a great deal of influence over which channels we see and which channels we don't see, and this is one that the Spanish-speaking world won't be seeing.
Yes, and you make, and of course people will be able to access it by using the internet and all the rest of it, and I think it just shows how scared the Western elites are by counter-narratives, which is what Press TV is there to do, which is to give the Iranian perspective on world events. And closing down their access to the population in Spain or in Britain is part of the preparations for a war, and people should recognise it for what it is.
And now, the channel Press TV has been banned here in Britain, but that was, as mentioned, at the beginning of last year, Press TV was banned. That's the English language Iranian channel. And his band TV has been banned too. So let's have a listen to a report on Press TV, which I got on the internet, by their reporter Amir Hussein, who also interviews one of the Iran's TV bosses about these close downs. Because obviously it's not a lot of point in them ploughing money into TV channels that then get shut down.
We continue to have live coverage of the developments in the Middle East, especially of critical situations such as the developments in Syria.
As of January 28th of this year, the Spanish government ordered Madrid's regional government to stop Hispan TV's broadcast. Their reasoning is defined to be a wider interpretation of the European Union regulations. Hispan TV was run on Hispasat's European satellite provider, Eutelsat. Hispasat is partly owned by Eutelsat, whose French-Israeli CEO is blamed for the recent wave of attacks on Iranian media in Europe. The vice president of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting explains how the Zionist system controls all the mainstream news channels in the world.
Because they want to proceed with their own agendas, they have to control people's thoughts, and they achieve this by controlling the largest news channels throughout the world. If a news channel comes and is an alternative news channel, then the Zionist system wants them removed.
Hisman TV, along with Iran's 24-hour English-language news channel Press TV, have been already targeted by Hispasat's fellow European satellite providers, Eutelsat and Hotbird. The vice president of IRIB questioned the removal of these stations as a violation of freedom of speech.
The U.S. talks about being the biggest advocate of human rights, free speech and democracy, yet they support the dictators and kings of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. They are worried of losing power in the Middle East, especially since many of their allies, such as Egypt's Hosni Mubarak and Tunisia's dictator Ben Ali and others, have been removed from power. In Latin America, the U.S. felt it was a free zone for them, and all Latin American countries should rely on the U.S. and not become independent. But they saw what Ecuador and Venezuela did, and others want to follow, and this idea is making them nervous.
Yes, nervous indeed. And I think in a way that what's being implied in that Press TV report there, Martin, that's the channel which is now banned in Britain by Ofcom, who have a consumer panel which is bizarrely, or at least it was anyway, picked by Odgers, the corporate headhunters, which doesn't sound very like a proper consumer panel to me. That what he's saying essentially is that, yes, he's agreeing with you. He's saying this is part of a preparation for war. Now, this is really rather worrying, especially in the Middle Eastern terms, with the Israelis and nuclear weapons possibly involved.
Yeah, well, I think they've been very unhappy because Press TV, basically, if people have watched it and they can still watch it on the internet, they will see that it presents the Iranian point of view, and surprisingly enough, they come across as relatively rational and straightforward people.
Yeah, the interesting,
which of course is what they really don't want people to get, well, is that the Iranians aren't crazy.
The interesting thing about
are,
this is,
know,
right the way through World War II, Lord Horhor was broadcasting from Nazi Germany, and it was considered to be a stupid thing to try and ban it, because that would just sort of make it look as if we were trying to send of things. Now there's no such attitude.
Well, it just shows that they're on the back foot, basically, and they're trying to, you know, they are making preparations for war, and this kind of banning of the other side's point of view is the next step to trying to silence them completely, isn't it?
Okay, well, we're joined on the line also, moving on to the Turkish story, by Steve Rose, who's a journalism graduate from University of the West of England. Hi, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks again for having me.
Okay, you have just come back, literally this week, I think, from Turkey. Can you just give us an idea of how you got to do this trip over there?
Yeah, essentially, it happened via Twitter, of all things. A journalist I happen to be friend called Miriam Serra messaged me on Twitter as the Turkish government were looking for young British students who study journalism, a conference in Istanbul. Now, since I graduated in 2010, I had to kind of argue my case, but I think it ended up they needed the numbers. They paid for my flights and hotel, and I was there from Friday. The conference ran last weekend, so I literally got back from Istanbul Monday.
Well, fantastic. But, I mean, how about defining Islamophobia? I mean, isn't that term itself problematic? Because, obviously, you know, you can be critical of Islam without necessarily being an Islamophobe.
Of course. And part of the conference was a discussion on Islamophobia. It brought together journalists from the UK and Turkey, as long as academics, so we were able to discuss linguistically what the term means. Now, you're probably familiar that the Runnymede Trust in 1997 published a pretty groundbreaking report on Islamophobia, which prophesized that Islamophobia is an outlook or worldview involving an unfounded dread and dislike of Muslims, which results in practices of exclusion and discrimination. Ultimately, the problem people have is that they focus too much on the phobia aspect of Islamophobia. It almost becomes akin to saying it's like arachnophobia. There's an irrationality to the term. Well, I'd argue otherwise, because it's not irrational when you're a victim of racism, you're being spat at, or having your hijab pulled off. This is a very serious issue, and I think for victims of Islamophobia, they have a right to use that term.
Okay, so this has been allowed to grow, this whole thing of Islamophobia. How do you think that the mainstream press in Britain has dealt with it, that is to say, both broadcast and press media, you know, sort of newspapers?
I'll start with the prints and the press media. Their behaviour is nothing short of irresponsible and very dangerous. And this isn't a recent phenomenon. This has been going on for many years. The best way to describe the print media is there's three types of Islamophobia. There's the unconscious form, which is born out of ignorance, where many journalists don't know many Muslims, or there aren't enough Muslims in the newsroom for them to kind of correct simple mistakes. And this becomes part of the narrative. Point number two is the conscious Islamophobia. This is the provocative and often inflammatory headlines that we often see. A most recent example I can give you, I'm not sure if you saw it this morning, but the Times and the Mail and many other right-wing papers, there was a landmark case where a Jewish couple were granted permission by the High Court for a divorce in a Jewish version of a religious court called Beth Din. But the headline wasn't that. It was clearly spun towards Sharia. As we know, Sharia law is a byword for essentially really Orientalist racism, and the print media, rather than focusing on just religious courts, decided to run with Sharia because it invokes certain connotations in people's minds. And finally, with the print media, there's Islamophobia for profit. It's a very conscious and money-making scheme where, much like B, it's a conscious effort to basically defame and be racist. I'd say Islamophobia is tied to racism in this country. And the media, especially the right-wing tabloids, are very guilty of this. Whereas if we look at the broadcast media, there's much tighter regulation. We have Ofcom, and it's harder for them to kind of get away with it. There is a clear, in the remit for objectivity, we don't see this in the print media. The PCC is inadequate. That's why we have Leveson. That's why we debate the role of print media. And online media itself is an interesting topic for Islamophobia because it can be edited instantaneously. Articles can be removed. But ultimately, the media is probably as guilty as politicians in the rise of Islamophobia in the UK.
Now, what about the fact that, I mean, we do read, don't we, and see that in places like Saudi Arabia, there's things like public beheadings going on. You know, this kind of thing is bound to make people recoil, isn't it?
Oh, of course. They should be clear that in certain Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, they practice a worse kind of Islamophobia, where people are executed for their religious beliefs, Muslim and non-Muslim, and we should condemn it. But we should also not lose the sight of the fact that Saudi Arabia represents one form of Islam. Islam is not a monolith. It's a religion full of diverse opinions. And the danger is you treat Saudi Arabia as a textbook example of how an Islamic state would function. And I think that's irresponsible for the media to portray it that way. But we should be critical of Saudi Arabia, but we shouldn't use it as a blueprint for Islamophobia.
Well, the interesting and ironic and rather scary thing about all this is that a place somewhere like Syria had a much more westernized version. Even though it was essentially an Islamic country, it was way away from Saudi Arabia, and yet it's Syria that seems to be the problem, not Saudi Arabia. Anyway, Steve, your conference you went to looked at possible solutions, and this is why I always love talking about solutions, because we know there's all these problems out there for tackling Islamophobia in the newsroom. Can you elaborate on any thoughts were developed at the conference over in Turkey about, you know, what the solutions are to this?
Oh yeah, of course. I think if you ask any journalist, they always try and spin it positively. They accept there's problems. I think there is a fundamental issue with diversity in journalism, not just for Muslims, for women, for people of colour. It's seemingly a white middle class game, and that would certainly go a long way, and you would find many journalists at the conference who would agree. If there are more Muslims in the newsroom, they would certainly be able to ask questions of their own staff. And it would help probably round opinions more. But I think, on the other hand, there is a danger that simply having more Muslims in a newsroom won't solve the problems. We have to look at editors as well and the codes that they stick to. Okay, let me put it this way. My analogy is, if we hire more Eastern European journalists, would we stop the xenophobia in the Daily Express and Daily Star? Probably not. I think there needs to be a wider discussion. And some did agree, some disagreed, that with more regulation, there needs to be a tighter, more stringent code that trains journalists from the hacks on the desks to the editors on the top floor that certain terms and certain reporting of Islam is not acceptable. I think that's one of the solutions people suggested.
Okay, what about politicians, though? I mean, you're talking about the ownership of the media and the people that actually own it and run it from day to day. They obviously decide on the mindsets of the individual journalists they decide to employ. But what about politicians? Are they guilty as well for the rise in Islamophobia?
Oh, certainly. I'm of the persuasion that the politicians are very guilty in this. The central thesis of my dissertation was Orientalism and Islamophobia. What we see is Islam exists in two paradoxical states in a post 9/11 environment. On one hand, if we look at pre-invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and post-invasions of these countries, we see a simple narrative that portrays the orientalized version of a violent Islam. Because if we're going to invade countries in Muslim lands, then we need to inform the public of their violent tendencies. Yes, the issues are more complex than that. But ultimately, the other paradoxical state is how we rarely celebrate Islam, that we rarely see positive stories. It's almost treated as a value system where if Muslims in this country subscribe to our values, then we will celebrate them, otherwise we will condemn them to justify the worst kinds of atrocities.
Yeah, well.
But also, on a further point, as the years have gone by, the narrative has changed. It's not about how violent Islam is, it's about cultural values, because the narrative has changed somewhat as the wars deteriorate or kind of come to an end, it seems.
Okay, I mean, I can't help but be reminded about Rowan Williams' statement that the old-fashioned church law in this country actually bears a lot of similarities. I mean, this is going back to medieval times to Sharia law. What are your thoughts about that? Because, I mean, what I suppose he's saying is that, I mean, do we really want to go back to that medieval church law system?
Well, I would probably argue that religious courts aren't inherently a bad thing. They work within the British legal system. Jewish people have best ins. And by and large, Sharia courts do exist within the law. A great example is they do largely deal with issues themselves. It can be inheritance. It can be small issues that aren't necessarily, it's not chopping off hands. Most will probably, if you're married, it's how you have your marriage recognized both in Islam and by law, and sometimes this doesn't happen if you come from abroad. Sharia courts are kind of, for the benefit, some would argue, largely for women. Ana Khan, who's a solicitor who specializes in it, would say 80% of her clients are women. So there are benefits to Sharia law. I'm not saying it should be the norm, because we have a good legal system in this country, but religious courts aren't something to be feared.
Okay, Steve.
I would argue.
Okay, Steve. You've just come back from Turkey. What about the state of play over there? Because this is a right on the eastern extremities of NATO. Difficult to see how the Turks can really be part of a Atlantic organisation, being right at the sort of eastern end of the Mediterranean. But given that they are part of the Western NATO alliance, they're sort of being tugged between two extremes, aren't they? You've got Islam and radical Islam on the one side, very, very rife in Turkey, as well as this allegiance to NATO, which seems to be involved in, I mean, particularly in places like Afghanistan, actually stamping out radical Islam. So what's your feeling coming back from Turkey about, you know, how that's all playing out, that tension between those two extremes in Turkey?
Oh, I do think Turkey is an interesting case study. I will say that I'm thankful for the Turkish Ministry of Youth and Sport for inviting us and paying for my accommodation flights. But it's interesting. I think Turkey as a country has mixed feelings on a lot of things. Big issues are that Turkey does imprison a lot of journalists, especially when it reports on issues like Kurdish independence. Now, given we've had an attack in Ankara, it's worth noting that the ministry are blaming the Revolutionary People's Liberation Party Front, the THKPC, which are a Marxist-Leninist group, which actually oppose the American influence of NATO on Turkish foreign policy. And it could well be, if it is them, this could be retaliation for, there was 55 arrests last month in Turkey of journalists and people, students, artists, involved in that movement. So there seems to be a constant clampdown of certain ideas in Turkey that perhaps we should be looking at more interestingly if there ever will be Turkish ascension to the EU.
Well, that's right. I mean, it sounds like the dark days from the past, you know, when Turkey really was seen as a horrendous abuser of human rights. Martin, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what's your view about this attack this morning? Obviously, we don't know who's caused it, but I mean, we do see a lot, don't we, in the press here, if we're looking for stuff to do with Turkey, of various movements which are simply not able to organise. We have, for example, the PKK leader. Obviously, they are clashing with the Turkish government majorly. The founder of the PKK in Paris killed a couple of weeks ago, along with two of the PKK, the Kurdish separatists. At least, they haven't got their own state. They're fighting for their own state, and Turkey is fighting to stop them.
Yes, and of course, Turkey, the Turkish military in the 1980s, 1990s, and into the 2000s, was involved in the so-called Ergonekon network, which was their version of Gladio, which was the sort of West European destabilization vector, if you like. And it's basically NATO is involved in Turkey, and the top generals have been sent to prison for this, for involving themselves in terrorism. In other words, this attack this morning might be being carried out by the Turkish military in order to undermine the civilian government. I don't know whether that's true or not. It's too early to say. But in the past, that was definitely what was going on. So the Grey Wolves, who were right-wing nationalists, secular nationalists, and other Islamist extremist groups, were actually being manipulated by the military. So that in the run-up to the first military coup in Turkey in 1980, which actually led to a military government which imposed the first IMF structural adjustment program, there had been a whole series of terrorist outrages in Turkey. And the military said the civilians can't run the show, we'd better take over. They did take over, and that's not the first time they've done it, or the last.
Well, the interesting thing about
that is
that
it was all organised by the military.
Well, the interesting thing about that as well is, just before Christmas, we had one of the generals was interviewed, and he's totally unrepentant. He was saying, I was doing it for the good of Turkey, never mind the democratic government.
Yes, and it wouldn't be the Turkish military acting alone. You've got to remember that all their chaps are trained at Sandhurst. So when the NATO military government, the NATO-backed military in Turkey, is involved in false flag terrorism, as if the courts have now now definitely determined, that means that MI6 and the CIA were involved. So you can understand why Marxist-Leninists might decide to go and try and blow up the American embassy, especially if their comrades have been tortured, killed or whatever. But they may, of course, themselves be being manipulated, because this is how it works.
Okay.
The deep state in Turkey, everybody talks about the deep state, and of course they're a NATO member, and we've got a deep state too. It's just less obvious.
Finally, back to you, Steve. Prospects in the future for free press in Turkey don't sound good. What you were giving us rather bad news about those arrests. What do you think? How do you think that's going to play out? And also, your thoughts about which direction Turkey is heading in, whether it's more of a pro-NATO, going along with US foreign policy, or whether it's going to sort of have some kind of possible, even like an Arab Spring type thing like they've had in Egypt, where a lot of the population simply don't want to go along with that.
I honestly think Turkey will continue on its path with NATO. I think if you look at the UK, and most... And yeah, it's only really France and Germany that oppose Turkish ascension to the EU. We have a strong commitment, well, our government does, to Turkey's ascension. So I think the relationship with NATO is pretty secure. If we look at the press freedom index, Turkey ranks very low. I think it's 186th out of almost 200 countries. It's in the lower parts. But again, it's a lot of the issues stem around Kurdish independence. There is a suppression of press, but also we need to realize that Turkey perhaps will reconcile with, or Israel will attempt to reconciliate with the Mavi Marmara. There has been rumors of that. Again, given Turkey's geographical location, it's a prime location for American bases. They realize the interest that both America and Israel have in them as a gateway to the Middle East. I don't think they're going to turn too far away from the script, if that kind of is a good way to describe it.
Okay, Steve Rose, journalist and graduate from University of West of England, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
The other bit of news we've had this week, Martin, is the sacking of the Timbuktu library and burning of manuscripts. I mean, this is one of those horrific episodes that you just wonder what on earth is going on, when mostly Arabic manuscripts from thousands of years ago, actually quite a lot of them are more recent than that, from the sort of 14th and 15th century, have just been torched. Now, it's not entirely clear who exactly has done the torching. Reading the Guardian article, it looks like the people who were occupying these library buildings weren't necessarily in any way officially involved with these Islamist rebels, but certainly, this is a pretty horrific episode, isn't it?
Well, it's a bit like the Taliban blowing up the statues of Bamiyan, isn't it? It's these are cultural treasures of the whole world. I mean, they were burning Qurans, so you have to ask yourself, well, what is the motivation here? It's just obscurantism. But on the other hand, of course, you've got to ask yourself, well, who are these Islamist rebels? Because they've been cooperating with Western intelligence services for the last 30 years. This chap that was supposed to be the mastermind behind the siege in Algeria, well, he learned his trade in Afghanistan, fighting the Russians, no doubt trained by British and US special forces. So people don't, the people need to realise that when these terrible events happen, and of course, burning books isn't the same as burning people, but when all of these events happen, there's usually a backstory involved which is more complicated than people realise.
What about Algeria as well, though? Because we've got these kind of jihadists, Islamists, running around in Mali and in Algeria, and yet there's not. It doesn't seem as if there's any question about them, where they got their weapons from. Most of those weapons, it seems, came from when the West was helping Al-Qaeda in Libya, which is right next door to where that gas plant was, for example.
Yeah, so you could argue that this is all kind of unintended consequences of the intervention in Libya. I suspect further that it's more than that. There is a clear policy to basically control Africa and keep the Chinese out. I mean, that's the main goal of Western policy, French, British, and US. And Algeria's government, of course, is not a democratic society. It makes Turkey is far more democratic than Algeria. The Algerians attempted to have a democratic election in the early 90s, one of the first Arab countries to do so. The Islamic Salvation Front, which was a moderate Islamic party like Erdogan's party, the Justice Development Party in Turkey, was going to win, and the military government in Algeria, with the backing of the West, including France and the US, smashed that, involved killing up to half a million people, and they smashed the Islamist uprising, and there's never been a democratic election in Algeria. So it's not surprising that there might be some people a bit disaffected from that. And, Cameron's been in Algeria this week clasping hands with the people who run Algeria. Well, hang on a minute, who are these? And who are the people running Mali? Oh, it's a military dictator who took over earlier this year. Hang on a minute. Who's the good guys and who's the bad guys?
Okay.
Well, hard to say, isn't
it? MP for Bradford West, I think it is, George Galloway, brought this up at Prime Minister's... I know you hate every time I bring up Prime Minister's questions, Martin, but he brought this up at Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday this week.
George Galloway!
Following yesterday's announcement...
Never here!
...will the Prime Minister adumbrate for the House?
Who is this guy?
The key differences...
Who is he?
...between the hand-chopping, throat-cutting... jihadists fighting the dictatorship in Mali that we are now to help to kill, and the equally bloodthirsty jihadists that we are giving money, materiel, political and diplomatic support to in Syria. Has the Prime Minister read Frankenstein, and did he read it to the end?
Well, some things come and go, but there is one thing that is certain. Wherever there is a brutal Arab dictator in the world, he'll have the support of the Honourable Gentleman.
Yes, a bit of a riot breaking out there, but he didn't really answer the question, of course, Martin. And what do you think about the point Galloway's making there?
Well, he's making a point that it's becoming obvious, even to people who don't pay attention to these things, that there's a bit of a hypocrisy here. So in Syria, the rebels are basically Islamists, of Salafists, many of them, sort of pro-Saudi, very, very anti other sorts of Muslims, very anti-Christian. But they are, you know, they're to be supported, whereas in Algeria and Mali, they're to be opposed. And of course, underlying all of this is geopolitical games. The Western intelligence services have used extreme Muslim groups in the Middle East to undermine regimes they don't like. And so if the Algerians were not in control of their Islamists, they say, well, we'll have to come in and control them for you. What we're really talking about here is oil, gas, dollars, keeping the Chinese out. That's what the ball game really is about.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Final story in our little look around the world. The Dutch Queen has abdicated in favour of her son. A lot of people suggesting that maybe our Queen should do it. Certainly on BBC's Question Time last night, several of the panellists saying the Queen should abdicate to William, because a lot of people see him as rather better than her, for whatever reason. But anyway, the Dutch Queen, Martin, is not just the Dutch Queen. She's also one of the, if not the major shareholder in Royal Dutch Shell, one of the oil companies we were just talking about, as well as being one of the chief movers and shakers in the Bilderberg conferences. Anyway, what are your thoughts about her stepping aside at the age of 75, I think she is?
Well, I mean, it's the sort, if you're going to have a royal family, the idea of stepping aside when you're 75 and letting somebody else have a go makes kind of sense. Although, if you're going to stick to tradition, they go on till they die, don't they? I mean, that's the medieval way of running things. I mean, it shouldn't matter. But as you say, the royal families of the world are not, in fact, entirely powerless. And it's come to light in this country, for example, that they've had a veto over various legislation, which was secret. Nobody knew about it, but they were actually vetoing legislation when we didn't know about it.
And also encouraging Home Secretaries to arrest people, you know, giving them a little sort of arm twist, saying, why haven't you arrested this chap yet?
Well, what they've got to realise, if they get involved in politics in a serious way, then they can be removed politically, because we don't have to put up with it in the final analysis.
Well, the chap that's taking over is William Alexander. He's the heir to the throne. He accompanies his mother to the annual Bilderberg meetings. He's no stranger to long-term ambitions of his family. As heir to the throne, he keeps his actions quite in the dark. But one of the things that he is in charge of, he passes his time with the Global Water Management Centre at the United Nations. In this apparently innocent day job, the prince can hardly refrain from pushing global governance. So that's another aspect to him. I mean, water is quite an important resource, isn't it? And it's used politically. I mean, particularly in the Middle East, the Israelis have done an incredible job in actually taking over water control of the water resources away from the Palestinians, who obviously, you know, in that part of the world, water is an incredibly important resource.
Yes, and of course, Turkey has basically put dams on the top of the Tigris and Euphrates, which means that people further down the line in Syria and Iraq have had problems with their water. I mean, water, oil, gas, these, sadly, are the things that people are prepared to fight over and die over.
And one of the great achievements of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, I mean, it almost sounds like you're not supposed to say that Colonel Gaddafi in Libya achieved anything. He's supposed to be some sort of evil, brutal dictator. But he certainly was able to drive around in the streets without being shot, which you don't really see in many parts of the Western world. But he also instituted an incredible, what was called the man-made river, didn't he, which was bringing fresh water from an aquifer under the desert right into people's homes and actually sorting out the water supply for the whole of Libya. That was a system which was then bombed by NATO.
Indeed. And you have to ask yourself the question, what was NATO's motive in bombing Libya's water supply?
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, he hit the headlines a couple of weeks ago now, and his name's Gary McFarlane. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
Your particular case was to do with you were working as a counsellor advising people for Relate. First of all, tell us, what is Relate?
Relate is probably one of the largest relationship, if not the largest relationship, counselling body in the UK, providing relationship counselling, family therapy, sex therapy to individuals and couples and families in terms of their relationships in this country.
Now, tell us how long you've been working for them. When you started getting problems with this business of, you know, your own expertise and ability to do your job being questioned?
I started working for Relate as a volunteer in 2003, and things really arose in about 2007, towards the end of 2007, and I was dismissed just towards the beginning of 2008.
So how long had you actually been working for them as a paid employee?
Paid... Yes, I was essentially a volunteer, but because I had undertaken sufficient training, I was being paid something like £7 something an hour relative to my other job as a lawyer. You'll understand it was really a community volunteer job that I was essentially doing.
Okay, and when did the problem start?
End of 2007, I guess Relate, whatever its agenda was, I turned up to do my afternoon, evening session with clients, and I was called into the office to express a view as to what my stance would be in terms of the provision of counselling and sex therapy services to same-sex couples. I didn't know what my stance was at that time in terms of sex therapy. I made clear that Relate knew that I counsel same-sex individuals, the closed files, the ongoing work. I will continue to provide counselling to same-sex individuals, even in my private practice now. That really was not the issue. At the time, I was training to be a sex therapist. Sex therapy is very different to counselling. Counselling is not about advising, telling people. It's about going on a journey with people to help them to come to a better place in their life that they decide they want. Sex therapy is coming at it from a cognitive behavioral therapy. It's CBT. It's very directive. I diagnose their sexual problem. I create a treatment plan, and I work through that treatment plan with them for something like 6 months to a year to help them to improve their sex life. I indicated to Relate that I didn't understand why you were asking me the issue, because there were no clients I was being asked to see. But really, if you're forcing me to express a view, then ultimately I would have to say it's going to conflict with my 30-odd years as a Christian. But I would comply with the equal opportunities policy, and if at some future date I face the issue, I'd like the opportunity to work it through with my supervisor and manager to see if we could come to a good outcome, because that's exactly what I had done before with counselling when I came across a conscience problem, and it was great to work that through and come to a good place where I said, nope, I can do this, this is not really a problem, that I don't see a conflict with counselling. But sex therapy, I was told I could not be believed, and that because I couldn't be believed, don't believe I would give the service, and therefore I was dismissed for gross misconduct.
That sounds a little bit peculiar, because it sounds like to me as if you had worked through these potential conflicts of interest in your own conscience and in your work before. What made it different this time?
This time I wasn't given the opportunity. I was training at the time. In truth, people can say, well, that's a bit naive, isn't it? But I'd practiced as a lawyer for 20-odd years. I've never come across a conflict in that profession. I didn't survey the terrain of counselling and then deciding to move into sex therapy and look at, am I going to face a problem here? I hope in society we could just work them through. On this occasion, really, I'm pushed up against the wall, because it really wasn't a question that I had even thought through at that point, because life was full on in what I was doing and training. I just wanted to get the training done. But I expressed a view which I thought was quite reasonable. Give me the chance to work it through when it arises, if it arises, in the future.
But I mean, what they're saying is you won't be able to work it through because your faith conflicts with the whole idea of same-sex couples. So how on earth can you advise same-sex couples when you actually don't even agree with that, that they should be same-sex couples? I mean, surely that's what your employers were saying.
That's what they were saying then, and I guess that's what ultimately, I guess I may well have come to that view at some future date. So yeah, if you fast forward it, you'll say, well, you're going to come to that point at some point anyway. I say, well, yes, I guess so. I would also say, well, the reality is, let's look at the sex therapists that were working at Relate at the time and ask each of them, how many same-sex couples have you been asked to provide a service to? And I think you will be very surprised at how few, if any, because you see, the gay community are very sophisticated. They face prejudice for many, many years. They will do a whole lot of homework to look into the choice of their therapist. They will speak to each other in the community, and they will go to a sex therapist who clearly they know have the ability to appropriately help them to improve their sex life. I really cannot see them going to a heterosexual sex therapist to help them to improve their sex life in a gay relationship.
I mean, would you, as a counsellor, talk to them about your own faith, or do you have to keep that secret?
It doesn't arise in my counselling. Talking about my faith just doesn't arise.
I mean, surely, you know, if you have a faith, then that plays a part in your counselling, doesn't it?
No. Not in terms of what the clients have come to me for, no. It doesn't.
Because, I mean, you know, your values and your ideas, surely that's part of what counselling is.
No, it's not.
Oh, isn't it? Okay, well, can you explain what counselling is if it's not that, then?
No, it's not at all. You see, what you will have is little Garys running around in society saying, live life like this. That's exactly why counselling is not at all like that. Counselling is about individuals recognising there are some aspects of their life which is not working very well. And we have some very good skills in asking particularly well-framed questions that causes the individual to go what we call a reflexive journey, looking at the issues. You see, so often we go into black and white thinking, I can't, and if we find a way to do something, we go over to extremes. I talk about bringing colour back to life, looking at the bits in the middle that we exclude very quickly and say, well, that's obvious, I can't do that. And I say, well, let's look at that again and let's work it through. Maybe there are some compromise places that one can reach in order for you to see a way to improve the quality of your life and your relationship. That's counselling. It's a journey. It's not about knowing anything about me. In fact, in a sense, I should be invisible.
Well, counselling is a journey, but you've had a journey through the courts. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was dismissed for gross misconduct. I was actually content to just go and set up privately. The dilemma was I was paying a lot of money for a diploma in sex therapy, and I needed a placement. I needed the client work in order to complete that diploma. So the dismissal meant loss of the clients. And it meant actually I couldn't finish this diploma, which was really quite costly because I was intending to do a career change. The ultimate thing was actually it put me onto benefits because really I couldn't promote myself as a trainee sex therapist, couldn't afford to, and it just doesn't work. You're a trainee. And so ultimately I said, look, I really shouldn't be chased out of this place like this. Agreed with somebody else who told me that. I lifted my head up and said, well, actually, that's right. I shouldn't have to be chased out of this. And a little bit of indignation came up in me, and I just said, look, you're just wrong. And actually, as a lawyer, I don't tell lies. And for you to say you don't believe me, actually, I really dislike that very much. So I pursued a claim in the employment tribunal on the basis of unfair dismissal based upon religious discrimination. The tribunals were absolutely against me, very robust in its condemnation of my stance. The Employment Appeal Tribunal were equally robust that I'm a bad person, really. And the Court of Appeal, a single judge that we had to go before in order to get permission to appeal, took the view that my Christian faith is subjective and that it is not open to any proof of any sort. And so what the European Courts of Human Rights is about, it is not about Gary McFarlane. This is not about Christians having a greater right than anybody else. It is about trying to say, really, individuals in society, where they have a strong conscience over something, not just a whim overnight that they decide, there should be a balancing of rights. You should listen to what they have to say, employers, and balance that against the service that you need to deliver to another group. It's not about preferring one against the other. Once you've done that balancing right, it may be that you say, but you still have to do it. In my case, my rights were not looked at all, was not considered. My Christian faith was not considered. You must provide this service to the same-sex community, but we're not even thinking about the fact that you may have a faith and some rights. It is just that this community are entitled to have this service. And what I am saying is, no, there should be something looked at of some criteria. It is regrettable the European Court did not take the opportunity to set out those criteria to help employers. That was a shame. That's why we're appealing it. But it's about reasonable accommodation. It really is about trying to get a level playing field for folks. And this case is way bigger than me.
Okay. Now, what about your wider... Because obviously you have to, in a way, keep your faith separate to your professional work.
Yes.
What about something like gay marriage? I mean, is that something that you would, in your... church life, if you want, is that something you would agree with?
I choose not to have a conversation with anybody over issues like this because there's lots of people who have a voice on it. But you see, I also choose not to have a voice very much about the rights and wrong of same sex on the radio because that alienates me from a community group. And because I'm a Christian, because I dare to stand up and say I can't do this to enhance the right of same sex couples, then I've got to be homophobic. The two are synonymous. Christian won't do, homophobic. I say that's really entirely wrong. So you won't hear me talking about the rights and wrongs of same sex. You won't really hear me on the radio going into issues of marriage. I have a view, I have a strong view, but expressing the strong view in the way that you want me to do alienates me from people before I can even have a conversation, and I don't like doing that at all.
Okay, Gary. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I wonder if you'd like to chip in, Martin, because this is an interesting case, isn't it, in that this particular, and I was sort of goading Gary in a way to sort of express a view about something which he clearly didn't want to talk about, but he's made it very clear, as a professional, he's not going to talk about this in public, and which is probably the right thing to do. What are your thoughts about the way his case, whether his faith should be accommodated in the modern world in a professional position as he is as a counsellor?
Well, I think it's very hard to, I mean, I don't know enough about this case to make strong statements about it, so that sounds like I'm copping out by saying that. But I think when you said earlier, as a counsellor, your beliefs as a Christian shouldn't affect the way you deal with people if you're counselling them. And you could be counselling a same-sex couple about their relationship, not their sexual relationship, but their relationship with each other, and that there shouldn't be any problem with doing that. And if you're going to be a counsellor, then you should be able to do that and do it in a professional way to a recognised standard. I think if you're talking about sex therapy, as you say, it's a more nuts and bolts thing, to be honest, isn't it? And as you quite rightly point out, same-sex couples are unlikely to go to somebody who they don't think understands what they're talking about. I mean, it's just a bit different.
Bit of a no-brainer. Anyway, Gary, you've set yourself up as an independent counsellor, running your own shop now. Can you tell us how that's going, where you are?
Yeah, I've always said it just feels so much... Can I just rewind very quickly? The professional rules actually tell me that you must remain within your competency. I don't know enough about same-sex sex therapy to be a competent sex therapist in that area. And I choose not to gain the knowledge. Therefore, I wouldn't be competent. Professionals will tell me, you therefore must not do it. That doesn't come into the case, by the way. So, yes, I've... The whole thing really was pretty crippling in a sense. There's professional bodies, College of Sex and Relationship Therapists won't allow me to become a member, so professional bodies have refused me membership.
But people may choose to come along anyway, mightn't they? So whereabouts are you?
So I'm in Brunswick Square, Surrey Street. I've set up an office, moved it out of my home. I'm a sex therapist, a relationship counsellor, sex addiction therapist, which is creating some major problems out there for mostly us guys, in terms of the extent of internet pornography. I'm a love addiction therapist. This hasn't yet really broken in terms of women and the excessive time they may be spending, particularly on the social networks, where their core emotional needs perhaps are not being met in other areas. And so the more romancing, the friends reunite and getting to know, meeting up with. So I am here still trying to get there in developing a service
Gary,
community in Bristol.
Got to finish there. Thanks very much for joining us, Gary McFarlane, that is, in Brunswick Square. He is now. Time to sign off. The Cyrus the Virus is up next. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That was Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Thanks also to journalism graduate Steve Rose and to Gary McFarlane. Also, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. See you next week.
Hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, two hitmen who killed the wrong person have been found guilty of murdering...